Hey, everybody. Today's episode is brought to you by Red Hen Press, publisher of the novel Unseen City by Amy Schoen. Unseen City is a multi-generational portrait of New York and the unexpected connections between a lonely Brooklyn librarian, a widower returning to his roots, and a ghost still lingering in a home that was once part of an activist-founded farming settlement, described as, quote, an entrancing story of falling in and out of love and grief with a city, a person, and a home by Naomi Jackson. Unseen City is the official September pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. Unseen City by Amy Schoen, available now from Red Hen Press. Best of all, get 40% off of Unseen City and your entire order for a limited time using the code OTHERPPL. Just go to https://shop.aer.io/red_hen_press. Use that offer code OTHERPPL, all right? Okay.
There once was a man from Nantucket who was also from New York City and Bermuda, New Zealand, and West Palm Beach, and he kept all his cats in an island.
Hey, everybody. What's up? How you doing? Welcome to the Other People Show. My name is Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It is good to be with you. It's good to be talking into this microphone to you. I'm very excited to have Stephen Dunn on the program today. He is the author of a couple of novels. The first is called Potted Meat. That was published in 2016, and the most recent novel is called Water and Power. Both are available from an indie press called Tarpaulin Sky. And Stephen Dunn was born and raised in West Virginia. He spent 10 years in the Navy. Water and Power deals with these experiences. I read it. I was really impressed with it. I wanted to talk with Stephen, and he was kind enough to give me his time. So my conversation with Stephen Dunn coming up momentarily. I do want to quickly apologize for the delay in getting this episode out. I had some AT&T internet issues. We had service guys here all afternoon, yesterday, into the night. They had to come back this morning. But the good news is we got it resolved. It was so stressful for me. Just because it's taken a long time, it's been this saga. It's like the third time AT&T has had to come out. The customer service experience was not pleasant. And then we had the debate last night with Joe Biden and Donald Trump. All of it together. I went to bed last night and I couldn't sleep. Just got me all like worked up. Customer service shit bugs me. Donald Trump bugs me. The whole thing. Just make it stop. It's got to stop. This is insane. Anyway, this conversation with Stephen Dunn should hopefully help restore some sanity. Give everybody a little bit of a respite from whatever static is out there and intruding upon our serenity. You know what I mean? Oh, and let me also remind you that if you want some Other People gear, you can get that gear, t-shirts, sweatshirts, tank tops, over at OtherPPL.com. Just click on the little t-shirt on the left sidebar. And if you're out there and you want to send in a photo of where you listen, we love getting those. Just email the show, letters@OtherPPL.com. Take a selfie, take a photo of your surroundings, whatever it is. Do both. I don't care. Send it in. Let us know where you are in space. You can also DM the photos to us on Twitter or Instagram. All right? Okay, so Stephen Dunn is the guest. His latest novel, Water and Power, is available from Tarpaulin Sky. Here he is, folks. This is Stephen Dunn.
My mom worked for the school. She was a cook for the school. There weren't a lot of jobs, but it used to be like a big-ass coal mining town, like really booming coal mining town. And people left, you know, so that's why it was so small. You know, it's just population kept decreasing and everything. So I had some friends in high school quit to go work in the mines, you know, so there isn't a lot to do there. Very small. You know.
And that never appealed to you to go work in the mines?
No, not at all. Yeah. It was good money though. I think about it, like my friends in like 99 making $32 an hour in West Virginia. I'm like, shit, man, that's like, that's rich, you know?
Yeah. I think about, I don't know if this is still a thing. I guess it probably is, but I remember when I was getting out of college in the, you know, mid to late 1990s, a lot of a lot of people, or not a lot of people, but some people would go up to Alaska and work on those fishing boats.
Oh.
And it was similar. It was like the pay, you know, for a young person coming out of college was really good. It's also a dangerous job, but if you didn't work on the boats, you could work in the canneries. And I want to say, if you did it for a summer, you could walk away with like 20 grand or, you know, whatever it was. But it was attractive for that reason. You could make like
Yeah.
a lump of cash.
Where did you grow up, or go to high school?
Milwaukee. I grew up, like, first part of my childhood was in Milwaukee. The second part was in Indiana.
Okay, wow.
So, you know, no coal mines, but I mean, Indiana, I don't know. Like Indiana and West Virginia, it's not entirely dissimilar in terms of the milieu.
Yeah, I don't think it is. Yeah. Even like some of the language, especially in southern Indiana, because some of that spillover from Kentucky and stuff. So, yeah.
It's that Appalachian, you know, what is it? Scots Irish. I don't even know what you call it, but I think there's a similar like migratory pattern or cultural history.
There he is. Yeah.
So what about your dad? Was he a coal miner?
No, my dad, he was an electrician, so he worked on TVs and stuff like that, but he didn't work much when I was growing up, but one of his jobs was being an electrician. So, yeah.
What do you mean he didn't work much when you were growing up? Was he older or did he just not work?
I don't really, he just didn't work that much. Like he had little side jobs and stuff, but he wasn't like going out every day and coming back in. So I don't even know what to call it, freelancing or part-time. I don't know what was going on, but yeah,
Well, no,
that's what.
that makes sense. I feel like that's what a lot of, I mean, that's what a lot of people do these days, right?
Yeah. He spent most of his time like volunteering to like coach little league football and baseball and stuff. So that's what he did mostly was coaching kids, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome. So he was involved.
Yeah.
And what kind of kid were you?
Oh man, I was fucking up all over the place. Not really fucking up, but just like I don't want to say bad, but just like the artistic mind. You know, I played sports and everything, but I was always outside, like hiking before I knew what hiking was. I was drawing a lot. I was super into rap because of older cousins and shit too. So yeah, that's kind of what kind of kid I was. Just like always in trouble in school for drawing in class, you know, that stuff.
But a good kid. You seem like you were a likable kid.
I think so. Yeah, I had a couple, like a few, like really solid good friends and shit. We were all really cool. So yeah, and like always bounce between like sports, the nerds, you know, and all of that stuff. So just kind of like cool with everybody, especially like going up through high school because I did that. You know, I played sports and I was in math field day and I went to vocational school. You know, and I was a little weirdo, so I had a little goth girlfriend too at some point. You know? So yeah,
Wait, were you goth?
I was not goth, but I liked it for some reason, right? Like I was attracted to her. Like that was part of the mystique, was this goth shit she had going on, you know? So we're like listen to music. So I'm like, here, listen to this Jodeci album, and she was like, here, listen to this Ozzy Osbourne
Ozzy goth? I thought like the Cure was goth. I don't know. I need to
I don't
study. I
know,
need to
maybe.
read up.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever it was at the same time, right? You know, it wasn't rap and R&B, so it was like weird goth, you know, to us or whatever. So yeah, we looked pretty funny in high school. Like I write about it, and you know, like people would call me JJ from Good Times and call her Dracula's daughter, you know. So we like walking down the hallway. I got 70s clothes on and shit, and she looks like a vampire, you know.
What was the like the racial makeup of, is it Kimball? That was the name of the town you grew up in?
I want to say Kimball was really black. So but my high school was about half and half, so I think we were mostly a black town in our like 400 people town. So yeah.
But the high school was pretty integrated. It was like it wasn't just like you were like one of the only black kids or something like that. It
No,
was.
yeah, not at all. Yeah, there were oftentimes like white kids were the only few, you know, like were the minority in some of our classes and stuff, especially in elementary school. You know, like there were like three or four white kids around. You know, we have I had a lot of black teachers growing up, had some white teachers too. So it was mixed. I want to say like maybe 70% black was my town, possibly.
Okay, and it was good. It's I mean, What was it like? Was there a lot of hostility? Did you grow up around a lot of like racial animus and stuff like that?
Oh, totally. Yeah, man. It was bad. Yeah. Especially like when we would go to other towns, like people would call my coach a nigger lover and shit. When we would go to these other towns to play football and basketball, and there was like, we still had Klan marches in the 90s, you know, in my town, like down Main Street and shit. So yeah, it was like really racist, but we had a black town. So yeah, it's so hard to explain.
Okay. Wait. What's going on when the Klan is marching through Main Street in a black town?
Nothing. We just mind our business and we like go on somewhere, right? Like, we just don't bother with it. You know, we see it, you know, but we just stay away from it. Rebel flags everywhere, you know. but also like the younger people wearing rebel flags, when people say like it's culture, not hate, or whatever, heritage, not hate, I feel like that was true for like my friends and shit in high school, because, you know, they would go to black clubs with their little rebel flag shirts on and some Jordans and maybe a FUBU hat and be breakdancing in the black club, right? So they weren't like, I don't think they knew. Like, to them, it was just like, this is just like some Southern redneck shit that we wear, you know?
Yeah, no, I hear you, because I, when they were taking down the, or changing out the state flag in Mississippi, and, you know, then they pulled it down in South Carolina as well. You know, there's been this movement in recent times, and yeah. As it was happening, I was kind of applauding, but I think in the back of my mind, I was like, shit, I used to have a Dukes of Hazzard lunchbox when I was like in first grade.
Oh my God, I tell that story all the time. I had a little Orphan Annie lunchbox, and one of my friends in school had a Dukes of Hazzard, and we traded. And my parents were like so mad that I had this fucking Dukes of Hazzard lunchbox, and they made me get rid of it. So I was without a lunchbox, like no Orphan Annie lunchbox, no Dukes of Hazzard lunchbox. You know?
Yeah, I mean, like the thing is, though, I mean, I was what? It's defensible. I was in first grade. I didn't know what I was doing. I just liked the General Lee. I thought it was like a fast car, and you know, I was a kid, and. So, yeah. I think when it comes to the Confederate flag and its place in like American cultural life, especially in the South, I do think most people, it's a cultural thing and somehow like is an emblematic of the South. But the problem I have is that all you have to do is think about it for like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh, yeah, this is a dumb thing to be embracing, you know, like to cling to it, even though people have said, you know, have pointed out like, hey, by the way, you know, this thing symbolizes, you know, secession and defense of slavery and all this, you know, like clearly awful shit. Like, I don't think it should be like some like hugely heavy lift for people to make a change mentally. And yet, you know, there's like this devotion to it that freaks me out.
Yeah, that's a totally good point, man.
So, you're growing up. You said earlier that you were hiking before you knew what hiking was. And as I imagine Kimball, I'm thinking of, you know, I'm thinking of like a rural area in Appalachia, like rolling hills and stuff. Were you out in nature a lot as a kid? Like, were you just wandering the woods and all that kind of stuff?
Oh man, yeah. Yeah, all the time. It was just, yeah, that was just like where we played, right? Yeah, we played in the streets and, you know, cut grass all the time and just walked wherever. So yeah, over the mountain, through the train tunnel. So yeah, just out in nature a lot. Yeah, it was just always around us. And like we grew up in a lot of there were a lot of abandoned houses and everything around. So nature was also like living with us in a way, you know, like we had to watch out for snakes and rats and shit, you know, in the house. And a lot of people were connected to nature in that way, just cause we were in it.
You hunt?
My uncle did. Yeah. I went hunting a few times, but I never did it myself a lot. We fished a lot, went hunting quite a bit with my uncles and stuff, but I never like took it up on my own.
So what about books? How do books factor into your childhood? Was it something you embraced from an early age, or is it something you came to later?
Something I came to later. Yeah, they don't. I'm writing about that now, how I read a lot in elementary school, a lot of like Beverly Cleary and stuff, you know, those things you read in as a young grade. But I only read one book from the time I was like from age 12 to 22. I read one book, which was The Old Man and the Sea which I like it. You know, I still read that book from time to time. But yeah, it was something I got into later. But when I started writing, I listening to rap albums, right? So I learned a lot of geography and social shit and history shit through a lot of rap albums. So yeah, you know, so like one like fiction book, so one non-textbook, only read one non-textbook throughout my 12 to 22 life. So
yeah, do you know why? I mean, because I think back, I probably read a bit more than that when I was that age, but I've heard similar sentiments expressed by guests on this show in the past, mm-hmm. usually, you know, male guests who throughout like, you know, those junior high and high school years, like adolescence, I guess you're just like so, you know, busy fucking around and being a teenager, you know, I don't know. Yeah. It seems sort of natural, you know, to kind of not be in like super like bookish nerd mode, though I guess some people are.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is interesting, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what, I think it is busy fucking around, but what I'm writing about now is we did that with rap albums. Like, we had classes, basically. Like, we'd all listen to a rap album and talk about it. We argue about it, you know? So we did what you would do with books in school with rap albums. So I was like, that was a type of study for me in this type of communal way of discussing literature or whatever it was. So yeah, I was like, we still did that functionally. It just wasn't with books. It was with music.
What were some of the formative rap albums of your youth?
Oh, boy. Illmatic, Nas's Illmatic, Nas's, pretty much Nas's first three albums. I want to say a lot. Tribe Called Quest. A lot of Tribe Called Quest.
I've been made fun of for admitting. Like, I'm always like, I like Tribe Called Quest, and everyone's always like, that's always the shit that white people say they like.
Oh, what? I never knew that.
I don't know what it is.
And that anytime anybody says they like it, I'm like, yes, yes.
Yeah, I love Tribe Called Quest.
Yeah, yeah, Tribe. And a lot of Heavy D, because my mom and my dad loved Heavy D, so we listened to Heavy D a lot, right? Like, I listened to it independently of them, and they listened to it independently of me, but we also listened to it together. So Heavy D was really important to me, too, which is also why I, like, struggled with a lot of other rap, too. I'm like, oh, Heavy D really don't call women bitches, and, like, you know, like, he's okay. So I struggle with a lot of other rap because of Heavy D, which is interesting.
Yeah. So you graduate high school in West Virginia, and then you go on to join the Navy. Is that right after you graduate?
Yeah, like the summer after. Yeah. Spent the summer, then left. Yep.
What prompted that?
Nothing. Just being poor, actually, and wanting to get out of West Virginia quickly, and I didn't know much about college. I had some older cousins that went to college, but I knew they were back and they were talking about money all the time. So I just didn't know, like, I didn't know you could get loans to go to college, actually. Like, nobody talked to me about this stuff. So I wanted to be an architect because that's what I did. Like, my whole, like, high school was doing vocational school and designing shit, making blueprints. So I wanted to do that, but I just didn't know that it was possible. So I just defaulted and joined the Navy with a couple of my other friends.
Do you have family members who were military? Like, was your dad military? Was there any kind of tradition you were following?
Not at all. Yeah. One of my uncles was in the military, but he didn't talk about it much, you know? And yeah, so yeah, I wasn't following any tradition, any like sense of duty, any sense of patriotism. It was, you know, looking at those like advanced commercials about learning the computers and shit, and then just wanted to get out of West Virginia. So it was just purely like functional and a way to escape.
And what year was this that you joined?
99. Yeah,
99. Okay, so pre 9/11.
Yeah, so it was like 2000 is coming up, learn computers and blah blah blah, you know, the cutting edge of everything.
Right, see the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about your book. And, you know, I have read not a whole lot in this genre, which I guess would be called, like, what, military literature?
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's nominally a novel. I think that's how it's classified. But, you know, you also point out that it's like an ethnography. It reads a lot like nonfiction. It feels like a hybrid form. Is that fair?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it is. I call it a novel. I think it's just easy to call it that. And I want it to be read from like front to back. And there's some shit that develops over time. And I think a novel can hold all of these different things. So I just like, it's a novel. We'll just read it as that. So.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I just finished a similar sort of book that everybody thinks is a memoir, but I'm like, no, it's really a novel. I promise you. But you know, for those people listening who have not read, you know, this book feels, in its like formal construction, like a work of literary collage. You're combining different elements. There's a visual element to your book. You have photos, you have, you know, reproductions of what I believe are official like brochures from the Navy. You have I think like excerpts or images of manuals around things like sexual harassment and those kinds of protocols. And so you're sharing like proprietary information or inside info. And rather than just producing it in text, you're actually sharing the images themselves. And so it feels as you're reading like, or at least it felt this way for me, like I was getting insight and perspective that I've never gotten before. And I'm just curious to hear you talk about how you settled on this kind of framework. Like, how did the book become itself? Did you start this way or did you land here after some trial and error?
Yeah, I landed there after some trial and error. So I'll start with about I hate military literature most of the time because it is singular in its voice, right? So even anti-military literature is like still a singular, you know, like heroic type of thing. So like functionally, I feel like they're similar to like pro-military narratives and stuff. And even anti-military books still focus on themselves as a victim. But I'm like, oh, we also have these other people who are also victims and other people in the military who are also victims. So yeah, it started out being like that. I was like, I want it to be multivocal and have these different things to it because of the textures of all of these documents and people's voices. So that's how it started off as. So I knew I wanted that. And then this fictional ethnography shape came later. You know, it's like write about a person like learning other people in the military or wanting to include these things. So yeah. And then as far as like those documents themselves, like the how to train gay people, you know, how to report gay people. There was the comic book that teaches you how to do that. And I couldn't reproduce that in text. Like it wouldn't do its job, you know, and I saved that before I knew I was a writer. I saved that comic book because I thought it was so stupid. So like it was something about it. I was collecting these memories, these documents and everything. So yeah, that's how it came about. Yeah. And wanting to offer like people the texture of coming across this stupid comic book or a PowerPoint brief that teaches you about sexual harassment. There's something about that material for me.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about this because I have not been in the military, but I can imagine that, you know, based on what little I know, that, you know, you're in an environment where obviously things are very orderly. There are protocols for just about everything. Efficiency is prized. There are, you know, systems that you have to follow and, you know, you're on a very like routine schedule and all the rest. And I think by virtue of that, I'm just imagining that it's not an environment in which a lot of critical thinking is either encouraged or, provided for time-wise. You don't have a lot of time typically to sit around questioning. You're probably not going to go to your commanding officer and be like, why are we doing this comic book? You know, you just have to sort of toe the line and get on with your day and do whatever you're commanded to do. You know, there's a chain of command that you have to follow. And so that's why I think your book is so powerful and why I responded to it so much is because even though you're not, as you said, the protagonist in a singular way, I very much felt your presence throughout as the inquisitor. and as an honest broker, somebody trying to understand something that is very complex. And, you know, I think by making it multivocal and by being so openly investigatory in your approach, you're honoring that complexity and illuminating it for the reader. So I don't know. I just, I was very, I have a lot of admiration for the place that you landed in terms of how you set it up. I'm kind of rambling, but it's all good stuff. I'm praising you.
Appreciate it. No, I appreciate it.
Yeah. And I think too about like, I think it's like a Mark Twain quote, and it's about how like a book, you know, when it, if a book is to be done well, it has to find its form. It's something like that. You know, there's only kind of one way to write or tell an individual story. And I think you got to the place you needed to get to tell the story of the Navy through a lens that made sense to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
And I want to talk as well about, or I want to talk more deeply about the decision to make it multivocal. All throughout the book, you feature interviews anonymously, with, you know, fellow soldiers. I think, are they all Navy men and women, or are they people from other branches of the armed forces?
Yeah, some from other branches, like the Army and Air Force. I think some people specifically say, like, oh, when I got out the Air Force, you know, so it's from other branches also. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Like, you set about to tell this, and at some point you went out and conducted actual interviews, or are these fictionalized?
I did conduct actual interviews. So, and it was easy to do because I had a lot of friends from the military and people that I still had access to, even though I wasn't in the military. So yeah, I mean, not easy, but like getting interviews was easy, right? To ask people like, hey, I'm writing this book. And I based that off of real life too. And it was like, hey, you told me about this like some years ago, you know, like I'm writing this book. Would you want to like give it to me for the book or whatever? And like, we have all of these underground conversations that we would never say, you know, aloud while we're in the military. So that was part of the reason too, is like, I've moved through the military having these conversations with people that I think are safe enough to have them with. Right. And, they'll tell me something. I'm like, wow. And we can't do anything with it, but you know, like support each other. So that's why I wanted the book to do that too, is like to have these conversations that we would have that you can't have officially in the military. So,
yeah. And I like, you know, I like the multivocal thing because it underscores just how big, you know, the armed forces are, how many different people, how many different kinds of people are involved, how many different levels of experience or kinds of experience people can have. Like, I think there's one person you interview who's like, you know, an amputee or lost a limb in battle and basically feels like they would do it all over again. You have other people who are a lot more negative in terms of their, like the way they apprehend their service and, you know, what it means to, or, you know, there's even an entire diatribe against the word service or at least a meditation on it, you know? So I don't know. There's a lot more ambivalence from other people, but I think that in the single perspective books that you're referring to, you know, some of the classic novels about war literature, there tends to be a single consciousness that things get filtered through. And it's usually like either a satire or, you know, I think at its best, it's some kind of satire or anti-war, you know, screed. But even there, you know, you're sort of missing a lot. You're missing the people who are like earnestly like wearing that uniform and really believe in the cause. You know, you do see a lot of that. It's not all people who are disgruntled or psycho. You know, there are a lot of good people. There are a lot of people in the military who are kind of whole heart in it for, like, I guess what you would call the right reasons.
Yeah. That's what I struggled with too, is like people who are like, I have my own views of it. Like, I'm cynical and negative about it, you know, but then like good people who are like really believe what they're doing is right and all of that. So I'm like, man, it's a struggle for me to even wrap my head around it in the military, you know? So yeah. Like, I may not feel this way, but they do, but, they might be wrong. You know, like, I might be wrong too.
Did you feel an acute sense of confusion in while you were in the military about what you were doing? Or was it one of these things where, like, you know, you signed up, you got very busy because the military is good at keeping people busy. And once it was over, you look back and were like, what the fuck was that? Or was it confusion all the way through?
It was confusion all the way through. I feel maybe like the first year I tried to like be in the military, right? Like, this is what I need to do to be here. And I was never any good at it. And then when I went to Japan and there were people, a lot of people protesting in front of the base. And I think that's one of the things that like made me think more deeply about it. And that started it. And then I started seeing more and more. And then I would collect newspapers from Bahrain. I have a lot of newspapers from Bahrain where it was like, fuck America, you know, and all of this shit. And I was like, man, this totally is not lining up with the message we receive, you know, from literature, from culture, from people in the street, from people in the military themselves, you know, like, we're doing great. This is blah, blah, blah. And I was like, stuff isn't lining up here, you know.
When you were in Japan, were you in Okinawa? Is that where the protests were?
Yeah, it was in Okinawa, yeah. And Yokosuka one time too, yeah.
Well, I just know that's where I know there's a big base in Okinawa that's been a point of controversy for locals there for a long time, so.
Yeah, yep. And I didn't know that, you know, I'm just like a little young dude in the military. I was like, oh, wow, this is, you know.
These people hate us.
Yeah. And I was like, I see why they hate that motherfucker right there, because I hate him too, right?
All right. So I want to ask you, like, what kind of soldier were you? I know you said you gave it your all your first year. But like, you know, when we sort of measure yourself against a broad sample of people in the Navy, like, where did you rank? Like, what kind of day-to-day soldier were you?
Oh, so terrible. I couldn't even like keep my uniform straight, you know, just like kind of sloppy, thinking too much too, like too critical of myself, you know, like of everybody else. And just like, it was easy to be in the military in a way, like I was just slacking pretty much for 10 years and I advanced, I made money, I was able to buy houses, you know, so like I was really shitty as a soldier or seaman, yeah, really shitty as a seaman, but I was smart enough to do my job, right? So like I was good at my radar technology and math shit, but I was just not good at being in the military. I got in trouble a lot. I went to one of the protests, like immigrant protests down in Denver, and then I brought the Mexican flag back to work. It was kind of big, and then somebody put a U.S. flag under my Mexican flag, so it appeared that I was flying the Mexican flag higher than the U.S. flag, which was an issue. So my punishment was to give training to everybody, like something military-related training. So I looked up how the military recruits below the poverty line and brought up a map of the concentration of recruiting stations and shit. And so I was like, the military recruits uneducated and poor people, right? And everybody got mad at me because they thought I was calling people poor and stupid. And I was like, but this is the reality of recruiting. So that's who I was, just kind of like knew you could get along and not get kicked out, but I could also like cause trouble. So yeah, I was a troublemaker basically.
But that's good. I feel like you walked the line. That's what you sort of like, you kept collecting a salary, but you also were subversive in the ways that you could be.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And you were in it for 10 years.
Yeah. And cause after the first 4 years, like I still wasn't sure about the world or anything, just cause I was so like protected in the military that, and I was in Hawaii, so I went from West Virginia to Hawaii, and I was like, I don't know, like, I can't get out the military right now, because I don't know anything. And they gave me some money, reenlistment bonus, so I was like, oh, that's a lot of money, $40,000, you know, for 6 more years. I thought it was a lot of money, so yeah, that's why I stayed.
Well, and what about 9/11? You get in what, the late 90s, and what, 2 years in, 9/11 happens. How does that change your service?
Oh my God, it was such a fucking joke. Such a joke. In a way that a lot of people who were in military beforehand, nobody was really that patriotic. I don't want to say nobody, but patriotism wasn't really like a front runner of people in the military. A lot of people were like, I want money for college. I want to travel, you know. And then after that happened, then like a lot of the attitudes started changing. And I can understand why that would change. But on 9/11, people always like to say like where you were. So we were in Hawaii and we didn't have to go to work because we weren't non-essential. And we all got drunk in the barracks and just like glad that we didn't have to go to work. We weren't glad about 9/11, of course, but it was like, oh my God, we don't have to go to that place today. And we were pretty much acting like college kids, I guess, you know. And then a lot of people who joined afterwards were like more patriotic and more serious. But other people in the military before like retrofitted that to themselves, you know? So it's like this one event. I mean, events, singular events change things, especially something like that. But yeah, so I just want to say it was a joke because I feel like it was easy for a lot of people to retrofit this attitude, even if they didn't have it. And it didn't always seem sincere, but I could be wrong about that. So.
What about your, like, what about the actual nuts and bolts of your service? Like, did you wind up over in the Middle East?
Yeah, I went to Bahrain once, but I was on submarine, so I didn't have to like physically go. We could volunteer to go if we wanted to, like the the interview in the book. So that was a fictional interview because it was one of my like experiences where my chief was like, "Hey, you can volunteer to go over there, you know, in the Middle East." And I was like, "I'm not going, you know, that's not me." So that was one of my experiences that I fictionalized as an interview for the book. But yeah, so, and it was just the nature of our job, right? We were intelligent, so we didn't have to go shoot guns or anything. So yeah, I didn't really like have to go, but more on a submarine and go underwater for a couple months. But yeah, it was interesting, but also like, I saw all the racism at the same time. I made a joke before a comedian did. I was like, oh, now like Muslims are the new niggas in America at work. And I got in a lot of trouble for that. Somebody called me racist, like all types of stuff. I was like, no, this is what I'm saying. Like, I can still see the racism in all of this and like what's going on in people's attitudes, you know, in the military with this. And I was like, I'm not okay with this. I can't be proud and I can't be patriotic because I still see all the racism. It's not different from Black people, right? So yeah, that was my take on it being in there.
Well, this is something that your book addresses that I think also distinguishes it in that you're talking about things that do not often get discussed in military literature or in conversations around the military, which is the experience of homosexuals in the military, issues of race, sexual harassment, the way that you know, female soldiers might be treated. A lot of the times this stuff just sort of gets buried, or it's occasionally there's an expose or some story that I'll see. Maybe I'm just not reading enough, but to me it felt like the right choice again, you know, to cover this stuff because, you know, as you describe, it happens often. You know, I'm thinking of the sexual harassment stuff. This is not some isolated problem. And it also was kind of confirming for me because I've always wondered about that. Like, you have all these dudes in the military who are full of all this testosterone and are, you know, trained for aggression and all this stuff. And there's very limited access to any kind of like social life or women or anything. And then suddenly there's a couple of cute female soldiers. I always think about those female soldiers, like what must it be like for them to be surrounded by all this, you know, like hyped up masculine energy.
Yeah. Man, you said it. Yes, that's exactly, yeah, it's exactly what it is. I don't know, some people like take it on, right? Like some women I've seen take it on, like they become one of the guys, right? And some women don't and they struggle with it. Yeah, I don't know. And that's one of the stories that I had to cut out of the book was because I had a woman, talking about sexual harassment, so giving me a firsthand account of her sexual harassment. And then Colin Kaepernick didn't kneel for the flag, and she was super offended. And I was like, I don't see a problem with it. So we got an argument about that, and she was like, don't put my story in your book. And I was like, all right, I cannot put it in the book then. So it was interesting that she was really critical of the military for like not protecting her against sexual assault and like protecting the people above her who assaulted her. But on one hand, she was not critical about, I don't want to say not critical, but on one hand, she was not accepting of somebody else, a civilian, not kneeling, I mean, not standing for the national anthem. So that was I don't know what to think about this still.
You know what? This is a pet peeve of mine. And it's sort of tied, or not tied, but it's very similar to the arguments and discussions around the Confederate flag. In that, I think, with like a very minimal amount of thought, one should be able to figure out that Colin Kaepernick, when he is kneeling during the anthem, is not like trying to piss on soldiers or like, you know, be some sort of like hateful anti-American. He's protesting racial injustice, and he's trying to, I mean, do we not understand what this is? It seems so obvious. He's been clear about it. Why are we trying to twist this into something that it's not? And why are we being such big babies? Like, the guy's protesting. This is America. Soldiers fight and die for that very right, so that people can protest their government. Like, the fact that he's actually exercising that right is now offensive. Like, am I missing something?
No, I don't think you are. But people feel offended, right? Like, they are part of this flag so much. Like, they're so linked to this flag that they feel like it's offensive, you know? And maybe they don't want to admit that this flag is also racist, too, right? Like, it stands for racism, too, you know? Like, there's a lot of racism done behind the name of this flag. So I don't think people want to do the work to think about what that really means.
Yeah, it's like, it is kind of a convenient, like, emotional exercise to just be like, that's my flag. You know what I'm saying? Like, and to sort of like chest thump and talk about patriotism and all this different stuff. But I don't know. It's just like, it just feels like so depressingly simple minded. Like it doesn't even take that much to figure out that, you know, the flag, like you're saying, it isn't confined to like one narrow set of meetings. There's quite a lot inside of it. And
yeah,
I don't know. This is America. We should be able to protest. I don't understand why people don't get that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
you're like, yeah, tell me about it, dude.
No, I'm just saying, like, I agree with you. It's like depressing and just, man, yeah.
So did you ever have any situations in the military where you felt physically threatened, like, you know, due to terrorism or any kind of like, you know, militaristic danger?
No, I haven't. Yeah, just because of my job, like being on submarines mostly, and then being like working with radars and satellites and stuff. So nothing like that, you know? Which is nice. And I wonder, like, would I feel differently? Like, if my body was under physical threat of violence, would I feel differently about it?
I would imagine you would feel differently, right?
Yeah. So.
Well, I think one of the, you know, more like harrowing parts of the book is the descriptions you include about submarine life. I have a cousin who is like a super genius, like nuclear physicist. He has like two PhDs. He's like one of these people, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, total math science, but like super genius. And he was in the Navy and would go out on, you know, what, like 3-month deployments, whatever it was, on these submarines. And I cannot imagine living underwater on a submarine for that long. How the fuck do people do that? That seems like nightmarish to me.
Man, it is a very like weird thing. And I've never had anything to compare it to until quarantine recently. And I was like, this is similar. Like, you have to stay in your house, but you can also call your friends and you can watch TV and shit, right? So yeah, I was like, really, I'm okay with quarantine because I was on submarines so much. But I think for me, like, I had to let myself like be crazy or like know that it's bad. I had, like, really take it down a notch, like downshift my whole being, you know, like to prepare myself to be on the submarine. You know, it's like what I was saying in the book, like, don't expect too much, you know, just like kind of be even killed, which is easier said than done. Like, it takes a lot of work to be that way. Yeah, it's weird, man. It's weird. And then, like, dudes, to be around that many goddamn men for that long is just not okay.
You know? Well, I mean, no, like, one of the more, like, stomach-turning passages is where you're talking about everybody, like, jerking off in the showers and all the people just, you know, bodily fluids everywhere. And then talking about how, I had never thought about how submarines dispose of human waste. I think you compared it to like a whale with diarrhea, how it's like, it's like blasted out of the submarine with 1,000 pounds of pressure. And I'm just like, oh my God, like how do you even, how do you keep it clean? I guess the military does a good job of keeping things clean, but it seems like it would just be filthy in there.
What, the inside of the submarine?
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. It's dirty. Yeah. It's like, no matter how much you take a shower, how much you clean, it's always dirty. There's like film, like a grease film, you know, everywhere. It's just the nature of the thing. It's dirty. You're always tired, you know. Yeah, it's a really weird thing. I'd never thought about the way submarine, like, you dispose of waste on a submarine either before I was on it. And I was like, oh, wow. I never, you know, that makes sense, you know.
What about mental health? I feel like people would get depressed. You'd be on a submarine for 3 months. You're locked down there like 1,000 feet below the ocean or whatever. Like, do you ever start to feel moods come on? People getting sad? Anybody get claustrophobic and freak out?
I've never seen anybody get claustrophobic. I think there's a test for that. But other mental health people, they don't really like test you that much for it. But yeah, people do get really depressed and angry. Like, I've gotten super depressed on there. Like angry, like little things will set people off, you know, like, and you'll start to see it after about a week and a half, you know, so like not even that far in. And then it's like full on from there, you know. Yeah, people get like mad about people chewing too loud, you know, just like simple things like really get some people's nerves. It is super fucking depressing, man. Like, yeah.
And then you come up, like, you've been down underwater for 2 months, and then you emerge from the sea, and they let you loose in, like, what, like Thailand?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, God only knows what, I mean, American soldiers, that's sort of like the popular knowledge at this point. It's just like, I feel like going back to Vietnam, you know, you have all these young soldiers on leave in these, like, port towns in Asia or whatever, and it's just hookers and booze, basically.
Yeah, it's like people tend to act like that anyway, wild or whatever, like getting off the ships, you know, whatever. But then, like, when you talk about people getting off of a submarine after a few months, you know, it's like, it's nuts, you know, it's crazy. But I just wanted to, like, not be around anybody. That was my thing. I was like, I just want to go to a hotel, sit in the bathtub, go eat some good food, and like chill out, and go the fuck home. You know.
I hear that. Like, I think that's me. Like, that's the writerly introvert in you. You're like, can I just not be around so many goddamn people all the time? And can I have like a clean room with like a nice? Yeah. That's how I think I would have been too. But you do see bad behavior. You know, I think when you've got that much like aggression and sexual frustration and all that kind of stuff, you know, sort of locked up inside of a submarine, and then, you know, people get out and have too much to drink. And I imagine you probably witnessed like some questionable behavior.
Oh, yeah, a lot. Yeah. And you can still get called a hero. That's the interesting thing about it to me, right? Like, you could be as shitty as you want to be in the military, but you still get to be a hero, which is, which I don't understand.
How do you feel about it when people come up to you? I'm assuming, especially when you were wearing your like Navy whites or whatever, like people would come up to you and thank you for your service at the airport or whatever. Do you ever get that? Like, and how does that make you feel? And then how does that average soldier relate to that? You guys must talk about it, right? How like, you know, civilians treat you.
Some people talk about, like, let's say with trusted people, right? You can talk about this. And with trusted people, you're like, I don't really like this shit, you know? Like, I don't believe it. You know, like, not everybody is a hero. So you can talk openly like that with some people. So I knew quite a few people who felt like that. And I knew quite a few people who didn't question it, you know? Like, they could have just gotten out of jail for beating their wife or whatever, but then go out in the street with their uniform on and somebody was like, thank you so much, hero. And they're like, you're right. You're welcome, right? I am a hero. Yeah. So a lot of people love it. I feel like that's the common thing. Like, they really feel like they're doing something important, so they think it's deserved, or they get upset when people don't acknowledge that in them, you know. And then there are people like me and my few friends who are like, no, don't tell me, please, you know. And I didn't argue with people before. Like, I would just say, you know, like if somebody says they're praying for you, I'm like, oh, your intent is good. You know, like, I don't necessarily believe in God, but I thank you for your prayer. You know, I used to be like that with people who say thank you for your service. I'm like, I don't believe it, but whatever. I appreciate it. You mean well. But I've started letting people know now. I was like, you know, I don't really like that. I don't feel like it's deserving. You know, probably spend too much time explaining it to people. But I just want to, like, put that in people's consciousness. Like, that's not okay all the time, you know.
Yeah, like, what should people say? There's nothing, right? Or, well, I don't know. Like, it's hard to know. You know, if you're talking to somebody who's been in, like, a war theater or a combat and is back home, it's weird for me because I think I tend to be predisposed to pacifism, and I'm not hugely in favor of armed conflict. I guess there are some instances where I could see it being justified if there's, like, an imminent threat to a large civilian population. I mean, it's complicated, but
yes,
you know, it's like I went through this with a cousin of mine who was in the Army, or no, was he in the Navy? No, he was in the Air Force. and he was over in Kuwait during the Iraq War, and I was really worried about him, and I was very much against the Iraq War. I didn't think the justification for bombing Iraq was there, you know, vis-a-vis 9/11. And I remember trying to, like, walk that line between expressing, like, concern for him and admiration for him, but also, you know, my, like also being honest about my disdain for George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the decisions they were making.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Same with me too. Yeah, I felt, even in the military, like, I felt that same thing. And we were doing these conversations. I helped put together, like, a veterans anthology, and we were talking about this idea of service. And one woman said, I feel like y'all do about, you know, like, saying thank you for your service. I don't want to say it, but I also want to show my concern. So I just tell people, like, hey, I'm glad you're home, or, like, I'm glad you made it home. And I was like, wow, that's caring, but it's also not, you know,
like, patronizing.
Not putting, like, this false hero worship on people. So yeah, I was like, that's good. I like that one, you know.
I'm going to steal that one. I'm glad you're home. That's a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're not on that fucking submarine anymore. Thank God.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's, like, that's the same dilemma that I dealt with too, you know. Like, you have good friends, and then, like, I'll judge them for, you know, like, just say something neutral, like, hey, glad you made it back, you know, like, I don't really mess with Butch, I don't think we should be doing this. But then whenever, like, you're wrong, we should be doing it, then I'm like, well, fuck you. I can move on. I mean, I'm still glad you're alive, but I don't have to deal with you, right?
what about what you learn about people? Like, I think from a writerly perspective, that you must get so much material from your military experiences, like, enough to sustain you for many books, not just writing about, like, explicitly military things, but just writing about the people you meet, because you're working in such close quarters with people from a variety of different backgrounds. Can you talk a little bit about that experience, and, like, maybe what, like, the, like, what is the racial situation in the military? Like the optimist in me wants to believe that it's better because you're sort of depending on one another for your safety. And is there a more egalitarian culture in the military than might exist elsewhere in civilian quarters in America? Or is that a fallacy?
No, I think on the surface it is, or, like, institutionally, right? Because let's say, like, the military was the reason a lot of Black people moved into middle class after World War II, right? So functionally it is, but I think socially it's pretended to be, because, like, you depend on each other. So often white people will ignore like the very real like racist things that black people have to deal with because they think it's egalitarian, you know, they think it's all equal because like we're getting paid the same, we're treated the same, but you know, you see favoritism shown and everything, and it's usually has something to do with race often. And it's okay for like if there's more than like two black people sitting together, some white dude can totally come up and like, if it's more than two of y'all, it's a gang, you know. Like it's a funny joke, it could be a joke, but like there's something very real behind that too that may not always be funny, you know. But so there's a liberty taking with racial things as far as jokes because they think it's all equal. So yeah, and ignore it. Yeah, somebody told me that too about somebody I was in the military with. They heard me on an interview talking about the racism. Like, I was in the military with you. You didn't experience racism. I was like, okay, thank you for telling me that.
yeah, thank you for informing me about the contents of my own experience. I appreciate that.
So I feel like it's worse in a sense because it's ignored and taken liberties with.
And what about the political culture in the military? I think, again, like outside looking in, popular perception would be that the military has a strong like right-wing orientation. Was that your experience within it?
Yes. Yeah. Strong right-wing or like neutral. So like liberal people kind of kept quiet. You know, like I definitely felt like I would have been liberal while I was in the military. But, you know, I kept quiet. Like, yes, I'm for gay rights, and other people like aren't. You know, or, like, I'm for immigrant rights. You know, like when I got in trouble about going to the immigrant march. And then, like, people are openly, like, conservative there. So, and then more quietly liberal. So, usually, like, the quiet people, you're like, okay, I kind of know what you are, maybe. You know?
Just so, like, a look in their eye.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what about, let's go back to books, because you said, you know, you had this sort of fallow period between the ages of 12 and 22 or whatever, where you only read a book.
Yeah.
But you were listening a lot to rap, which I think, you know, it sounds like it's like a form of interacting with poetry and thinking deeply about it. I mean, that's the way I would sort of conceive of it from a literary perspective. But at some point, things must have shifted, and you must have started reading more deeply. Can you talk about when that happened and what kinds of books were really speaking to you?
Yeah, I what is it? So I started, I was reading Nikki Giovanni's love poems. I think that was like one of the first books that I read, like after that long period of not reading, was Nikki Giovanni's love poems. And I still have that book too. And something from Harriet Tubman, I started reading that. And then Kurt Vonnegut too. So those were like the things when I started reading again. I was like, oh yeah, yeah, cool books. I remember liking books in my life, you know. And but I still didn't think about writing. I didn't want to be a writer until like a few years later, because I was a visual artist. So I was still painting and everything. And I had an art show. I had an art show, and my wife came to the opening. She was like, "You ever realize how many words you have on your paintings?" And I was like, "Ah, you know, that's what it was. You know, like preparing for the art show, something didn't feel right, and I didn't realize like I was doing with words what I felt like I couldn't do visually anymore." So, yeah. And then at that moment, I was like, "All right, I should start writing." I think I was like 26 when that happened. So. Yeah, so I started writing again. I started writing at 26.
And reading more, like I imagine you undertook like a more serious program of reading at that point?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and listening too. So I went back and started listening to rap like closely, like more closely, like Illmatic specifically, because I wanted to write about West Virginia. And I remember feeling like I was in New York while listening to that album over the years repeatedly. So I went back. It was like, what is it about this thing that makes me feel like I'm here? So I started applying a lot of that stuff to my writing, like to writing my book and everything. And more reading too, like kept reading Kurt Vonnegut, of course. Just finding like a whole bunch of different stuff to read. Yeah, it's nice.
What was it about Vonnegut? I mean, I'm assuming what spoke to you about Vonnegut is what speaks to most people. I mean, it's the humor, it's the, I don't know, the deep like morality and kind of clear-sightedness that he has around issues of war and peace and social justice. Like, that was it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And definitely like the humor and yeah. And just like how weird it was too. So it just made me think about a lot of different things. Yeah. And I actually had a friend who was like, "Hey, have you read Kurt Vonnegut?" I was like, "No, I've never heard of him." You know, it was a friend in the military too. Yeah. A friend in the Navy who was like, sort of like me in a way, you know, and he asked me, had I read Vonnegut? And I never had.
I love hearing that. I love hearing that Vonnegut is circulating among active soldiers, or at least, or recently active soldiers. I was just like sort of extolling his virtues. And like one of the things that I think gets missed about him and about any of the quote unquote anti-war novelists in particular from the 20th century is like what a deep sense of patriotism he's operating from too. There's such a there's such a grief in him. As a through line to all of his books, there's such a grief in him over America and what has happened in American life in his lifetime.
I always thought about it too, but thought about like how it wasn't like, you know what I mean, like I'm a young black dude in poverty, so that wasn't his. So I feel like the America he's grieving was never the America I was grieving, but I still liked, you know, I still liked his work, but I always recognized that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like different idea. I think like obviously coming at it from different vectors and life experiences, but wouldn't you say that like both of you are grieving an America that's fallen way short of its highest ideals?
Yes, totally. Yeah, you're totally right about that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think also, too, like, the plain language for me, I don't want to say plain, you know, I'll say plain language, like, seemingly, like, straightforward language what Vonnegut had and the playfulness and everything. So that's, yeah, and I love this. So I just, like, started reading all of his books, and it was pretty great. Yeah. And I had to stop reading Vonnegut when I started writing Water and Power, because, like, if I don't, I would probably write another Vonnegut book. So I should stop reading Slaughterhouse-Five, you know.
No, it's definitely your own. And I think knowing that you're a fan of Vonnegut, you know, I think I can like retroactively see more solidly the influence that he may have had. I think the integration of visuals, you know, and that sense of play and you know, I'm thinking of Breakfast of Champions, I think is where he's illustrating and drawing assholes and all that kind of stuff.
Reference him in the submarine story about the human zoo thing. Like, I made sure to reference Vonnegut because like it was a big source of my reading, you know.
And I think, you know, there's something about, I mean, his war experience was super horrific. I don't know, I mean, I guess if you read him you probably know a bit about it, but it was really bad. And I think maybe even for me, I want to say I read something recently that got into the details of what he actually went through or some of the most horrific things. And it exceeded what I already knew. And I knew that he had been, you know, in it, but he was really wrecked by it his whole life.
Yeah.
I think it, you know, I don't think he ever fully got out from under it. I don't know if you could, but I guess like a question to ask is, do you feel that because of like, even if you didn't go into combat and you didn't really witness the kind of destruction that a soldier like Vonnegut may have, or like a frontline soldier in Iraq may have or whatever, because of just the inherent stakes, like when you're on a submarine, even if you're not, you know, in active combat, it's still dangerous. The possibility always looms. And there's also a sense of, for a person like you or Vonnegut or anybody who's thinking critically while they're in the midst of all this, there's always got to be this sense of confusion over duty and purpose. And like, what the hell am I doing here? And is it right? Like, you know, like all that kind of stuff. I think the question that I'm getting to is like, do you think, I guess it makes sense to approach a literature that in, involves the military with this kind of deconstructive, collagey, multimedia, playful kind of approach. Like to come at it on a straight line almost seems like it wouldn't work. You almost have to come at it like this in order to make any kind of sense of it. Or at least that seems to be the reflex that like you and a writer like Vonnegut and a writer like maybe Joseph Heller are working from.
Yeah. Yes. And it's, especially for me, it's like, I can be as critical as I want in the military, but I'm still in it, right? So like, I'm participating in this thing that I'm critical of, which is, I still struggle with that to this day. You know, it's like, do I even have a right to be critical of this thing and the people in it when I'm also doing it or also did it? So yeah, I struggle with that a lot. But I wanted the book to reflect that struggle too. It's like the person narrating is, you know, like self-reflecting also about his participation in these things. So, and I don't know if the answer ever, you know, or if there even is an answer to that. So,
well, you were such a young kid when you joined, like almost everybody is who joins the military, you know?
Yep.
I think it's hard to you can't be too hard on yourself for decisions that you make when you're 18 years old.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Especially with advertising.
What about any literature by African American or soldiers of color? Like, is there any like literary precedent that you were pulling from? I'm trying to think off the top of my head, and sadly, I can't think of anything immediately. Like a writer of color writing about their military experience in a vein, you know, similar to or of the same sort of general literary family as a writer like Vonnegut.
I can't think of the name right now, but I have a book called Bloods, and it was by a black dude from about Vietnam. You know what? Come to think of it, this might be this Five Bloods thing that Spike Lee just did.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's ringing a bell.
Oh, wow. I have this book on my shelf and didn't even think that's what Spike Lee was doing. Wow. Because I haven't seen Spike Lee's thing. But yeah, I have this book called Bloods, and that was good to look at. Like, they talk about the racism. Nothing like too satirical that they've been doing or like deconstructing, but it was more about like the reality of their experience as black people. So like formally, a lot of this stuff was similar, but I can't think of a lot of other like military literature by black people. And that's, maybe I haven't done my research enough. Yeah. But for me, like what did it the most, that book, what influenced the book most for me was Waltz with Bashir. Have you seen that movie?
No.
Yeah, I'm from West Virginia, so my L's don't show up in the middle of my words often. So Waltz with Bashir, the dance, it's by Ari Folman. So it's about an Israeli, when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982. So he's going around like, what did we do there? You know, so he's asking all of his friends, what did we do? And I saw this movie when I was in the military, like I think when I knew that I was going to be writing, but I never thought how it would play in anything. But yeah, that movie right there. And like, it's animated, but at the end it switches to this real footage and it fucks me up every time I see it. So like that thing is, so it's not necessarily like, I mean, Israeli, so not black, but someone like not white American, you know? So that was another precedent I had.
Okay. So now I'm psychoanalyzing this a little bit, and you talked about how it fucks you up when it switches from animated to actual. And I'm wondering like if you thought about this and if I'm on the right track in thinking that maybe because of the nature of your role in the Navy, like you said, you were working in intelligence and were, you know, doing radar and you were on a submarine and you were sort of away from combat, but you were helping to facilitate it in some way. Like it strikes me that like work of that nature in a militaristic context has a certain abstraction to it. And that I could imagine, and I think too, like my cousin, I want to say, was doing drone tracking, you know, like tracking from a distance targets for drones, and they might have even been firing them from the states. You know, these things are all computerized, and it's kind of like a video game. Mm-hmm. And I could be messing up some of the details, but I think about the abstraction of that process, but the very real world hardcore consequences of the work, and like how to bridge that divide. Is that something that you have struggled with? Am I barking up the right tree?
Oh, totally. Yeah. You are like in the top of the tree. You barked up there. You're at the top of the tree. Yeah, that's yes, all the time. And that's kind of like what the end of Water and Power is wrestling with too, like the drone story in there, like closing that distance from like having these people, like these ghost-like people show up in this person's apartment, and then switching to the real stories from victims themselves in the military. I mean, civilian victims of the military, switching to those stories, and then to the list of like actual names at the end. So that was me like trying to mimic what Waltz with Bashir was doing, like switching the footage, right? Animated to very real things, but also wrestling with that distance, you know, like we have this luxury of distance from what we do most of the time, but this is the reality of it. So yeah, you totally spot on with that.
Okay. And you know, I'm curious also, like after going through all this and writing a book about it and obviously wrestling with these issues, if you feel defined in your views of the use of military force, if they've changed maybe since you were in the military, you know, if we look to a guy like Vonnegut, he was obviously a pacifist and, you know, I don't know. It always feels a little complicated to me because he generally advocated for pacifism and nonviolence, but he never talked about World War II as a war that should not have been fought. I think he called it a just war in the, you know, if I'm remembering his books correctly. So
he did.
He obviously saw a necessity for combat in a certain context, at least. And just curious, like where you fall on that after a decade in the Navy.
Similar, like always a pacifist. But I like what you said earlier, like exactly what you said, like there could be a time when it's absolutely necessary, and I would not support it if I felt like that was absolutely necessary. But that could also be wrong too, right? Because a lot of people felt like the Iraq war was absolutely necessary. So you know, like what you said is really complicated, and just because I may feel like something is just a just war one day, it may never be just, or yeah, so I don't know.
It's tricky.
Yeah, and I always question World War II, like, was it really just? Like, people say that often, like, was it really a just war? I'm not quite sure. One thing I'm sure, like, somebody should have fucked Germany up, for real. Like, I'm sure about that one. I'm not a pacifist on that one, right? So yeah, that shit was just in that instance. The rest of that shit, maybe, I don't know, you know?
I mean, yeah, like you talk about like what happened in Japan and the, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think you can have a real debate, but Hitler, I feel pretty unequivocal about.
Yeah.
I'll give a more modern example because it's also something that I just was having a conversation about with a friend. And she was like bagging on Obama, who I'm generally a fan of, but she was like, he did so much drone warfare. He bombed a preschool and like all this stuff. And I'm just like, first of all, I don't know this story. So I'm like Googling like Obama bombs preschool. I'm like, did he bomb a preschool? You know? And I have a hard time believing that he is not a decent human being based on all that I know and have heard from him. I know we're not supposed to give politicians too much of a benefit of the doubt, you know, inherently, but like, I don't know. Yeah. I have a lot of love for Barack Obama. And I guess like when I started to think more deeply about the issue of drone warfare from his perspective or from the perspective of any commander in chief, as you're sitting there, I think from the outside looking in, it would be like, yeah, don't drone bomb anybody. Don't do that shit. But then what if you're like the president and you're like the head of the CIA or,
the National Security Agency comes to you and they're like, by the way, there's a camp in Afghanistan where they're training terrorists and they're going to blow some shit up and kill possibly thousands of civilians. Do you know what I'm saying? And so if you do nothing and you let this thing fester, then you might wind up having more blood on your hands than if you do something. Like, I'm at least willing to entertain that idea as legitimate. Like, what are you supposed to do? If the decision-making process or the decision-making authority is really yours, like, that's not an easy calculation. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't want to have to make that decision. That's a horrible decision to have to make, but I can see how Obama could be rationally assessing it and could be like, well, this intelligence is pretty strong. You know, my guys are telling me that it's rock solid and like this is what it is. If I don't put an end to it, thousands of innocent people could die. And if I don't use a drone, then we've got to put soldiers on the ground and they could get killed. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it becomes...
Yeah. My wife makes that exact same argument because... I'm like, who did you say you were talking to? A friend of yours?
A friend of mine. She's like she's like to the left of Che Guevara. She's like the leftist person I've ever met in my life.
Oh, man. So, yeah, that's like, I'm usually like in line with your friend. I was like, Obama, I'm going to get on my goddamn nerves. He drove so much shit, like drone bombs. So much. And my wife is like, what you're saying. So, like, I've been wrestling with that too. Too, like, man, I struggle with Obama. Like, yes, I'm sure he is a good guy. He just doesn't want to kill anybody on purpose, like any kids on purpose. But then there's the reality of what was done that I struggle with. So, yeah. And like being in during that time too is like,
you know? Right. Yeah. I mean, you have a different perspective on it. And I should say too, like I might be susceptible or probably am susceptible to looking at him through rose-colored glasses, both because of who came before him and like the antipathy that I had for Bush and Cheney. And then also who came after him. You know, it's easy for it's easy to deify Obama in present context. He sure looks good right about now.
You know? Yeah, totally. Yeah. Like I struggle with him. Even like I put it in the book too, you know, like the fictional part of like being at the ribbon cutting ceremony. You know, like I struggle with the fact that a black dude is now like the president and still fucking everything up overseas. You know, like I struggle with that fact. Like, oh my God. Yeah. Like that is very true, and I'm not always fine with that, you know, like with that type of representation. I think he didn't sign some order in Cambodia, so they don't like him in Cambodia to like clean up the weapons or something, and like he could have easily fixed it. And this doesn't seem like a moral quandary either, but then so like children are still like picking up these yellow beads and bombs and getting messed up, you know, and he could have cleaned it up. So I'm like, in Cambodia, they don't really fuck with Obama, you know? So, but that's the thing, right? Like, that comes with this job, right? The job of president. So, yeah, it's weird.
It is weird. I think we have a pretty troubled last 100 years of American leadership in relation to the exercise of military power. Like we've been at war for the last, almost 100 years. It's been 80 years.
Yeah.
It never stops.
Yep.
So what about getting to writing? Like is your first book Potted Meat? Is that it? It's Potted Meat in this?
Yeah. First book is Potted Meat. Yep.
So, and I didn't realize that you were a visual artist. Did you have training in this or you just came out and started painting or?
Family members and stuff, like cousins would teach me how to draw and paint. And, you know, I took art classes in high school and stuff like that in middle school. So, but no, like really like great formal training. So it was a lot of like learning from people and myself. Yeah. And Potted Meat is a lot about that too. Like a lot of painting and drawing and doing all of this stuff.
Okay. And then you started to get down to work on Potted Meat and what did that, what did the composition process look like? How long did it take you?
It took me a few years. And because I was coming out of painting too, I didn't realize that. But at the time, or like in the beginning of writing, I was like writing a lot of 3-paragraph stories. So like totally like composing stories like I would a painting, you know, like here's the background, here's the middle ground and foreground and So Potted Meat has a lot of three paragraph stories, which is interesting that I didn't realize I was doing, you know, consciously at first, but after I picked it up on, I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. So yeah, 3 years to write. And it's a lot of like short vignettes and stuff. And because I hadn't read a book, you know, or like hadn't read widely, one of my teachers, when I was writing Potted Meat, she was like, oh, this reminds me of The House on Mango Street. And I was like, oh, cool, I'll read it, you know. And I picked it up and read it, and I was like, shit, I need to quit writing my book because my book is like copying this book, you know, accidentally copying it. But I pushed through and wrote it. So it's very similar to like in structure and style to House on Mango Street.
But just like a happy accident.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm glad I read it, though. Like, it did shut me down for a while, but I'm glad I read it because it did, like, help me out and stuff eventually. So
how does a guy from West Virginia go from being in the Navy for a decade to being in Denver, Colorado?
Oh, I was stationed out here, yeah.
You were?
Yeah.
There's a Navy base in Colorado?
No, the Air Force base, the Buckley Air Force Base.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so because, like, you know, satellites, radar jobs and stuff. I was on a lot of joint commands. So yeah, Buckley Air Force Base has a lot of Navy people there, intelligence wise.
Got it. Okay. Is that down in Colorado Springs?
No, it's in Aurora. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you've been there ever since?
Yeah. Well, I was here from like 2004 to 2007. Then I went back to Hawaii. And then I liked it out here so much that when I got out the Navy, I just moved back out here.
Yeah, it's good living in Colorado. I like it there.
It is, yeah.
It's gotten hotter, though. I feel like it's been hot. My friends have said it this summer was like Phoenix.
Yeah. It's hotter here, yeah.
All right.
And I noticed the change around like 2010. Like 2010, like it's been hotter out here. It's just really weird, yeah. Or 2011, somewhere around there.
Well, it's only going to get worse. I hate to break it to you.
Yeah, like when I was out here from like 2004, it was like nice and cool. And you know,
yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, we're dealing. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. We're like just getting through the fires. And I don't know, man. Climate change. I know there's a lot of people worried about it, but I don't hear enough people talking about how worried they are about climate change. Like, we should all be really fucking worried.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, it's good to talk with you, man. I really enjoyed this book. And I feel like it's even if you're not in the military, maybe especially if you're not, it's a great book to read to get a real sense of what it's like in contemporary times to be in. Not just like in practice, but also what the psychological and emotional landscape is like, you know. And there's a level of depth there that's really unique. There's some dark humor in it. I don't know. You're doing a lot of different things well. And I suppose like the last couple of questions that I would pose to you is, first of all, like, what has been the response to the book by friends of yours or readers of yours who are in the military or who have served? Have you heard from these folks?
Not much. Yeah, it's been a really quiet book. A few people that I know, like in the military, read it. They're like, "Wow, like you did it!" You know, it was like you got all the boring stuff. You know, like it wasn't all heroic and action driven. So they felt like it was representative of a lot of military life. Yeah, a few of them. So yeah, like good people that I know who read it were like, "Yeah, I feel you." You know, few military people who read it was like, "Oh man, you really got Japan down." You know, so they kind of skirted around the bigger stuff that the book was dealing with. And I haven't heard from many like strangers in the military who's read the book. So yeah, that's, and one of my friends read it and he was like, "Man, how did you get to work at the taxidermy museum? I was like, that wasn't real, man. Like, you shouldn't know better. That wasn't." You know, But to him, he was like, "I was wondering." He was like, I didn't get to work there." I was like, "Yeah, because it didn't exist, you know."
Right.
So enough of the book was real enough to him that it was convincing, you know, to him that it was there.
So are you working on anything new?
Yeah, I am. I'm writing a book now about Nas albums. I mentioned that earlier. Yeah, and Van Hunt. I don't know. Do you know Van Hunt?
No.
He's a musician. Like earlier, he was sort of in like the neo soul camp. They put him in there, but he's been making albums. He lives in L.A., so I'm writing a book about him, his albums too. So those are like my two big things right now. Books about music. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, it's a pleasure to meet you. Congratulations on Water and Power. Best of luck on the Nas book and with life in Colorado.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and sorry about all the mishaps and stuff getting this thing together, but I'm glad we finally got to do it. So.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Best of luck to you.
All right. Have a good one. Thanks.
All right. That is Stephen Dunn. His novel, again, is called Water and Power. It's available from Tarpaulin Sky. His other novel is called Potted Meat, also available from Tarpaulin Sky. Stephen can be found online at StephenCDunn.com. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle at Twitter is S.C. Dunn Jr. at S.C. Dunn Jr. Stephen Dunn, Water and Power. Go get your copy immediately. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Every single episode of this show, more than 670, is that what it is? Episodes? All of it is available for free. It's a listener-supported show. If you like the program and you listen regularly and you get something from it, throw a couple of bucks in the hat over at patreon.com/otherpplpod. Of course, this assumes that you have a couple of bucks to spare. If you're not in a good situation financially, I totally get it. Don't sweat it. If you are and you can do it, patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com, letters@otherppl.com. You can send in a photo of where you listen, or you can DM the photo over at our Twitter feed @otherppl or on Instagram @otherppl.podcast. This program has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. The app is free. Go get the app. It's a great way to listen. If you want to get some Other People gear, t-shirt, sweatshirt, tank top. The t-shirts are really good, you guys. They're soft. I like them. They fit well. They're good t-shirts. They're not scratchy. Do you know what I'm saying? You can get a t-shirt. Just go to otherppl.com, click on the t-shirt in the left sidebar. Next week on the program, I have Dean Koontz as my guest. The man has sold more than 500 million copies of his books. it's hard to even like wrap your head around. But Dean Koontz will be my guest. You know his name. You've seen his books at the airport and whatnot. Interesting conversation. All right.